Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Welcome to Star Trek From the Holodeck. I am Michael, your host. This is Rayman Digital's exclusive Trek theme series. If you're new to our podcast, you can find all of our shows past, present, and in the future. Wherever you listen to podcasts, just search From the Holodeck. Hello, David. How are you?
Hello, everybody.
All right. So we have a very, steep road to climb or steep mountain to climb today, because just to be completely upfront with everyone, we are attempting to do the impossible for us. We are a little behind.
Yes, we are. We had a little turbulence.
Yeah, in our personal lives, and now we are behind and we're trying to catch up. So we're covering two episodes today. They're going to be separate, but I'm letting you guys know that there may be some cross
talk.
You know, we might bring up things from the next episode, because that's unfortunately what happens. We forget sometimes when we have to watch two episodes in a row, and we're going to cover that second episode as well.
Yes.
So please be patient with us. We're going to try to hopefully and carefully get through the next two discussions. All right. So in this episode, David, we are going to be breaking down, discussing Star Trek Discovery's fifth season. But the third episode of the fifth season, titled Janal, written by Kyle Jarro, Lauren Wilkinson, and directed by Andy Armaganian. This episode did a few things, and it did it surprisingly quickly.
Yeah.
It clarified the existential crisis that Burnham is facing this season, which is more directly connected to what some call the ultimate meaning in life, the search for higher power. The conversation at the end of the episode, for example, between Burnham and Culbert, created a moment that clarified the thematics of the season, although I don't really feel like it needed clarification, but it did go beyond the simplistic search for meaning. I think that's what they were trying to convey in this episode, that the search for meaning that has been built into the season so far goes beyond the typical existential crisis of I must find meaning in my life. This seems to be connected in a spiritual way. There's this push towards not just individual meaning, but spiritual meaning. You know, that typically people find in one search for faith or possibly even God. And it does seem like they're trying to position this idea of the progenitors, not as gods, but they are our creators.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that someone or something is the reason why we're here, it's going to generate questions, much like the questions that we have pertaining to God.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar. So in a lot of ways, this is what that episode did. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about that throughout our discussion. But first, David, I want to get your general thoughts on the episode.
On the episode, I do agree with you that basically this episode feels like this was them just doubling down and reiterating what they were, what the story's myth arc was going to be that was established in the first two episodes. This was their attempt at fully defining so that there is no questions about what this season's going to be about, what the goal of the Discovery crew team is. It's more than just they're going to chase after a great weapon or a mystery of the season. Because I know that a lot of people who criticize Discovery say that every season has to be about the Discovery crew finding a mystery. They have to go save the universe.
Yeah, they're the Scooby-Doo of Trek.
The Scooby-Doo of Trek, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is basically, they're really trying to go back and actually capture what past series have done, which is, you know, like what TNG and the original series did, you know, really delve into the philosophical aspect of science fiction and kind of tap into the one taboo thing that science fiction tends to actually veer away from, which is a spiritual aspect. When science fiction in general usually delves into questions of God and godhood and mysticism, a lot of people feel that that's when science fiction becomes science fantasy. You know, that's the difference between Star Trek and, say, something like Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Star Wars is sci-fantasy because it embraces the mysticism. It embraces the question of, you know, not everything has to have an answer. You have to have that unknown aspect of the universe to embrace. In Star Trek, it's always been everything has to have some bit of logic to it, some bit of science.
It needs to be grounded in science.
Grounded in science.
You're right, David. They've always taken the mystical and found ways to ground it in some form of science, or at least leave it open to interpretation. They did this in, there's one episode in particular that I absolutely love. It's Star Trek Voyager. It's an episode of Star Trek Voyager that was about B'Elanna Torres.
Oh, the Klingon dream?
Yes, and it was titled The Barge of the Dead, I believe.
Yes.
And B'Elanna essentially has this like intense experience related to Klingon mysticism. She experiences what she believes to be the Klingon afterlife after being clinically dead for a brief period. And it delves into her struggles with her Klingon heritage and her relationship with her mother. Now, that was an episode that really was intriguing because it seemed to insinuate that an afterlife does in fact exist for the Klingon individuals. But at the same time, if you look at episodes in Deep Space Nine and Next Generation that also tackled Klingon mysticism because of Worf's involvement, many times they would do similar things, but they would always try to explain it as there is a scientific explanation behind the mysticism that, in fact, an afterlife could exist.
Yeah.
But it's not some divine connection. It has nothing to do with divinity. It's just simply a part of science that we don't quite understand yet. That's why the Trill aspect of this episode was very interesting, because the Trills, there's a type of mysticism to it, but it's more metaphysical than mystical. And that's how they've always tried to take those notes of the divine, the notes of the afterlife. They take those aspects and they demystify it.
Yes, because like the strength of Star Trek when it in the past has ever dealt with something like this, the one thing that they've always been able to do successfully is to explain it not in a mystical way, but just like what you said, a metaphysical way, where it's you're crossing dimensions, you're crossing, and then you're dealing with parallel dimensions, and you know you're dealing with basically more than the two-dimensional way of thinking. You're going into the fourth dimension type thing.
It's the reason why we both liked, I want to say it was the third season of Star Trek Discovery. That's what we liked what they did with the Trill in that third season.
Yeah.
Because they took the ideas from Deep Space Nine that we witnessed with this consciousness transfer, with the transfer of consciousness from symbiote host to non-symbiote host or non-Trill. They did this with Dax and Deep Space Nine a couple times.
Oh, yeah.
So they did what they needed to do at that time. It was very different types of television. Nowadays, you can do all types of cool things, experimental things to try to reify the non-tangible. And that's what they did in this episode as well. So they take this idea of the Trill consciousness or part of the Trill consciousness and transferring it over to a non-symbiote host. And the way that we see it, the way they show Culbert being immersed with suddenly by this consciousness is just an interesting way to help the audience visualize an experience that was always possibly there. Like, this is possibly what Dax experienced.
Yeah.
But this particular episode and the prior episode in season 3 of Discovery, they choose not just to tell you, but they want to show you what this person experiences when they're dealing with these varying consciousness. So there's always been a demystifying aspect to much of the so-called mysticism in Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And bringing it back to, you know what? We didn't finish. So what were your overall thoughts, Dave? You never really got to that. So overall,
I just felt like this episode to me felt not as polished, not as good as the first two episodes, but it still continued on with that narrative, the narrative strength of the past two episodes, by carrying it on and basically kind of reaffirming, okay, this is what it's all about. We're going to try to take all these characters and kind of find the way how they fit together. And that's overall the strength of like what this third episode was.
So you understand the moving parts, but you don't feel like the episode was able to effectively convey those moving parts. Is that the best way to say it?
Pretty much, because when it comes down to it, the weaknesses, and we'll get into it later on, the weaknesses of this episode really fall onto the execution of probably the biggest thing that me and you have always harped out with any of our shows that we cover, which is writing. The dynamics and the techniques of the writing here are not as polished.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. This, for me, was a bit of a struggle because overall, the episode offered some pretty interesting aspects.
It did.
To the revolving myth arc or narrative of the season, but how it was done, it's not the strongest script, and it might be one of the poorest scripts since the season 3 Sakaal reveal. It's up there. There's a lot
of... You had to reopen that wound, didn't you?
There's a lot of issues with the script, but let's focus on what the episode was doing, and then we'll get into some of those less than stellar script moments. So the progenitors are taking on more than just a scientific explanation of the origins of life, but something deeper. Whereas TNG... secularize the origins of life by demystifying it with the introduction of the progenitors. The writers of Discovery, however, are engaging in a more nuanced exploration, not merely secularizing or rationalizing, but rather delving into the complexities of spirituality and existential inquiry. It's as if Discovery is inviting viewers to contemplate not just the origins of life in a scientific sense, but also the profound questions of purpose, connection, and the nature of existence that have long been intertwined with concepts of divinity and transcendence. So they're not just retreading on what TNG did, they're taking it up a level. And in that, look at it from that perspective, that is the strength of the episode.
Oh no, absolutely. The concept itself is very interesting to me since they introduced it in the first two episodes, because this is, I guess you could say, this is a very taboo subject for science fiction. Anything dealing with God or like a species creating another species, science fiction has always had a problem with that, specifically with science fiction fans. And it usually falls really flat. And in
some people don't like the ancient astronaut theories.
Yeah. Say, for example, like two great examples of this in science fiction, just outside of Star Trek, is Alien Covenant or Prometheus. Prometheus is such a dive. It destroyed the whole concept of the astronauts basically being the creators of Earth, humans and everything else. And then they tried to actually deal with the same idea, the same concept of, hey, let's try to explain the purpose of humanity. And it felt flat because,
dude, that concept is highly philosophical.
It's highly philosophical, and you can't.
It's hard to make. Look at Terrence Malick, one of the greatest philosophical directors in modern history. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
His movies are so cerebral, uber intelligent, but the average moviegoer is turned off by everything he does.
Yep. Just turned off.
Because it's deep material.
Mm-hmm. And like when you take a look at that for science fiction audiences, that's going to be a really tough pill to swallow. And the fact that Discovery
mm-hmm.
is tackling it. But the thing I really liked since they established in the first two episodes is they're going to tackle it from a different direction. I have never seen any science fiction series tackle this question of humanity's purpose in the universe.
Because even if it isn't God, okay, a God is just a matter of perspective. For all intents and purposes, the progenitors are our gods. It potentially changes in universe, in canon, it potentially changes the perspectives on God. But whether you view this as the Judeo-Christian God or simply an ancient astronaut, it generates questions.
Yes.
The human tendency towards curiosity is piqued. You're like, well, why did they make us?
And see, like, that's the thing.
What are we supposed to do here? Like, why did you do this?
Instead of like other series that would actually pose those questions in a more external way,
mm-hmm.
Discovery turned it on its head and say, let's turn it as an internal question. Let's make it about a question of self. Don't make it a question about the entire universe.
Correct.
Make it a question about your inner self.
Yeah.
And like,
which does work with pretty much everything Discovery's done since day one. It does.
That's been their MO.
Why do you think the name is called Discovery? We talked about this during season two. In a lot of ways, this series revolves around the individual and the idea of self-discovery.
Like, it's not about the exploration part of Star Trek.
They're playing on that notion.
Yes.
But that's not what it's about.
It's not about that.
Yeah.
It's about the discovery of one's inner self.
The exploration of the self.
Of the self.
Yeah.
So by doing that, they're doing something completely different than any of the other sci-fi series out there that when they've tackled it, it's fallen flat. Mm-hmm. But I think that the way that Discovery's posed it is a much more, I use this term loosely, safer way of a science fiction story delving into this concept.
Because they're tying it to the existential feelings that the crew of Discovery are feeling.
Are feeling, yeah.
I think that's the reason why it works, because you're right, David. It's very different than other sci-fi properties that have tried to explore this. It's very different than Star Trek V.
Yeah.
You know, where they were literally looking for God. One of the best movies ever. Best I don't care what ever. Anyone says.
It was the funniest, one of the best moments ever. Why does God need a starship?
Yeah, dude, listen. I need that on a shirt. All right. So in essence, they are not only expanding the lore of its universe, meaning Star Trek, but also challenging viewers to reconsider their perspectives on the search for meaning and the role of spirituality in the human experience. And it is quite the feat, as you have been voicing. Star Trek has walked the line of metaphysics before. Here they are intertwining existentialism with metaphysics, and the two can work in parallel to provide a multifaceted exploration of the human condition and our place in the cosmos, but it's dangerous. That's all I'm going to say. Dangerous. It is very dangerous.
Oh yeah,
because it's a tightrope.
This is dealing with a concept that usually makes a sci-fi series split very divisively.
It's the reason why metaphysics is a branch of philosophy and a branch of study that a lot of people try to avoid.
Yes, it is honestly, it's a lot of things that basically people don't want to talk about, because if you think about it.
Dude, I took a metaphysics class years ago, and I remember the first thing the instructor said in the lecture was, this is very hard material. If this is simply an elective for you and not part of your required degree, I would recommend that you head out the exit.
Head out the exit. Because
you're going to be reading some of the most difficult, dense, philosophical writings you ever seen in your life.
And it'll hurt your brain.
Yeah. Yeah. So interestingly enough, the Trill stuff was positioned, I would say, to provoke metaphysical reflection. It's just the nature of how the Trill species works. It pairs nicely with the metaphysical. The idea of dual consciousness was an intriguing way to float particular questions about consciousness. For example, when Colbert asked, how is it possible? How can such a thing happen? How does it work? The nature of consciousness and how it has risen within humanity has been a question that has and still does stump scientists. What is the nature of consciousness? Why do we have it? What is it? Where does it stem from? These are questions that scientists are still grappling with. Cognitive scientists don't have any answers to this. So the fact that Colbert says, I don't know what this is. How can this happen? How can two consciousness combine? He is literally showing the philosophical attitude needed to explore metaphysics.
And it is one of the coolest things that Discovery introduced when they brought back the Trill, to kind of bring back that concept of the power of memory.
Mm-hmm.
Memory was one of the core ideas and core concepts of why this concept works.
The
power of math, people. Instead of the power of math, it's the power of,
the power of metaphysics, people.
The power of metaphysics.
I still think that's one of the worst lines in Discovery.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the power of math, people.
You wanted to throw, I remember when we first saw that, you wanted to throw the screen, throw your cup at the screen.
David, if we're going to make fun of things, let's just go with it for a second, because that's one of the things. I'm allowed to do this, okay, Star Trek fans? I love Discovery. I always talk about how great it is, so I'm allowed to talk shit about it as well. One of the stupidest things about Discovery is its constant need to pat itself on the back.
Yes.
And say, look, we understand science, guys. We're about science. We're about math. No other movie or TV show ever brought attention to science and math. It was just built into the DNA of the show. Here, it's like they're trying to prove to everyone, hey guys, look it. We understand science. We understand what Star Trek is about. We are doing our research.
Well, I'll tell you the honest truth. That's one of the reasons why in this episode, I have fully, the one of the bright spots of this episode that I really liked was Rainer. Because Rainer spits at that notion that you're talking about, which is like, and patting themselves on the back, going, kumbaya, let's all get together. And Rainer's like, going, no, I could just do this really quickly. Tell me, that get to the point. Yeah, I don't need Rainer to be praised.
I'm Rainer. I'm like, please, yes. I can only tolerate 2 minutes of you. Please, 20 words or less. Tell me why I don't throw you out of airlock right now.
That was the best thing. I was like, going, everyone's like, oh, he's so mean. No, don't waste the man's time.
Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into our episode 4 discussion, because a lot of that is fleshed out and dealt with in the next episode very nicely.
Very nicely, too.
I think it works really well. I get what they're doing with Rainer. I was hoping they weren't trying to make him into like bad guy 5.0, like some guy that just doesn't get the dynamic.
Doesn't get along well with Disco's crew.
But in a lot of ways, David, his introduction is actually the writers of Star Trek Discovery tackling questions or criticisms that have been launched at Discovery since day one, dealing with the familiarity and the lack of professionalism on Discovery. We've said it. We've said that this is a very touchy feely group of people. And we've also said it makes sense because of what they've been through. So when you throw in a wild card like Rainer, it makes for an interesting
dynamic.
Yeah. And also remembering David, and this is sad, remembering that no one knew at this time that Discovery season 5 would be its end. It's sad because it looks like they were shaping Rainer to be a permanent, not just this season, a permanent fixture on Discovery. Yes. And now that the show is coming to an end,
makes you want to cry.
It's a little sad that we have such an interesting character that throws a wrench in the chemistry. And every good season of television should do that at one point. They did it in season 4 with Worf for Deep Space 9. The series wasn't quite working. I enjoyed it, but it needed something else. When mm-hmm. you brought in the aspects of the Dominion in season 3, then you bring in Worf. They did it with
Georgiou.
They also did it with Star Trek Voyager. You're right. They did it with Georgiou. They did it in this show already as well. Why do you think those characters, why do you think Georgiou was such an interesting character?
Because she was, yeah, because she buckled the trend.
Yes. She generated problems in a good way.
In
the types of problems we want to see. We want to see personality conflicts. That's different than, I know people have this idea that Star Trek, these people should never fight because crews get along in Star Trek. That was the dream of Gene Roddenberry. Okay, listen. Gene Roddenberry's dream was not necessarily about the individual. It was about the society. It was a communal transcendence.
Yes.
That we rose above our petty differences. But that doesn't mean we're not going to have individual problems. And individuality is never going to mesh perfectly. There's always going to be personality clashes. That's actually part of the human condition.
And I think that's also one of the strengths of this episode in concept form, was the fact that one of the themes that they tried to emphasize in certain aspects with relationships that were going on in this episode was conflict is key. It is okay to have differences.
Isn't that what Terrell said?
Yeah. So
is that her name, Terrell?
Taryn. I think it's Taryn.
Trina.
Because T-R-I-N-A, is it?
I don't know. She it's one of those names with a fucking hyphen on it again, or a comma, whatever.
It's the Star Trek comma.
No, the Star Trek Discovery comma. This is a new thing.
But like when she actually tells Saru that basically, hey, I know this one side of my constituents will actually disagree with my decisions, and this side is gonna probably hate my decisions, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's Tarina. Yeah.
And then like,
but you're right, the fact that she even said that was the best part about the episode in a lot of ways for me, besides the exploration of the Trill consciousness and how it transferred to Culbert, mm-hmm. was the Saru and Tarina stuff. We had said that the relationships in Discovery are always a little awkward. And in a lot of ways in this episode, I feel like their relationship smoothed out a bit. Yes. My problem was I didn't believe their connection.
Yes.
And just little things, and my hat is off to the director for going with this, if this wasn't in the script, but just having Tarina touch Saru on the chin with her finger, that to me made their relationship that much more viable and realistic.
And it seems like a little thing for you know, average mass audiences listening to us right now. It may seem like a small, tiny little detail.
Oh, it's so important.
But it is important.
That's the importance of directing. That's where television directing really comes into play.
It is important in performance as a actor. And like, that's why people always say the power of a glance, power of math, you know, it's the little tiny details that will actually make the performance and the characters believable.
Yeah.
That's the problem I had with Saru and the Vulcan president in the first two episodes. I did not believe their relationship was very close because their body, their the way that they were performing to each other just felt like there were two people having a simple dialogue.
Yeah. And I think having that conflict be the bridge to show the audience that there is a connection there. I think that was smart because at the heart or at the center of the episode, it was about conflict and how conflict is necessary oftentimes to recognize our errors.
Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing going back to why I like the Rainer stuff with Tilly, because Rainer and Tilly, not saying Tilly and making fun of the Discovery crew as they're naive.
They're a little soft,
but
let's be honest. Let me just be very hyper masculine right now. They're a little soft, and I will be perfectly honest. I don't think my personality would flesh with them.
No,
I would be more like Rainer.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be like, listen, man, I just don't have fucking time for your emotional fucking meltdowns. I just can't do. We're all adults here. We have a doctor. Go talk to the doctor.
But that's be an thing. Adult. Yeah, exactly. Be an adult for God's sake.
Yeah. Listen, it works for me at a television level, but just knowing my personality, I would be annoyed.
Like imagine yourself, Mike, in the middle of the crew constantly, day after day, and you would have to have like all these kumbaya moments during the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Of like, we need to hold hands and hug each other.
And I get it. And we'll get into that a little bit more during our discussion for the next episode, because I believe that probably has a lot more to do.
Yes. Yes, it does.
With things. So we also had a little bit with Gray and Adira. It seems like this was the episode used to pair people up and work through certain things like conflict, or I should say specifically conflict. And we saw the same thing with Adira and Gray, who are going through their own conflicts, inner as well as interpersonal. And we now see that this essentially gets us to the point where they decide that they really shouldn't be together. They have grown apart.
Yes.
So that being said, when you look at the components of the episode and what they were doing, I can look at them favorably. I get what they were doing.
Yes.
But the execution of all of it, except for the Rainer and Tilly stuff, a lot of it didn't quite work. That's not to say I didn't enjoy seeing Culber. What's Culber? The actor that plays Culbert's name? I always forget his name.
Oh.
And I really don't want to do that. Give me a sec. Oh, Wilson Cruz. I think seeing Wilson Cruz be able to play Jenal Bix, I'm a big fan of characters being able to leave their comfort zone and do something a little different so that the audience can see their range as an actor. And Wilson Cruz has some range.
He does.
Man, he is so good.
Yeah.
How long now have we said that we love this dude? And we're finally getting to see him do something outside of his wheelhouse in an episode like this. Maybe that's the benefit of having more of an episodic hybrid serial, because then you can move into little episodes that can focus on other characters. What does it mean for Wilson Cruz's character? Or I should say, what does it mean overall for Culbert? I think he's also coming to terms with purpose and meaning. His experience is now causing him to have questions. So all in all, I can understand what they're trying to do, but the script itself had lots of problems. For example, the way they close out the episode is probably some of the worst writing I have ever witnessed in Discovery. And again, this is from someone who believes that Star Trek Discovery, for the most part, has been a very strong series. It's had some ups and downs. It's had some growing pains, but overall, I do enjoy Discovery, and I think there's a certain type of intellectualism that is unique to Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean there isn't room to nitpick, and a script like this is one of those moments. It beat us over the head. We didn't need to hear the conversation.
No. It was between unneeded.
Burnham and Culbert about the meaning of life and purpose. We didn't need to hear that. we were already clear on that based on the amazing work they did in the first two episodes.
Yes.
We were all very clear that this is a season geared around notions of existentialism and the seeking of purpose and meaning. We got that.
Yeah.
We understood it. But then we had the conversation between the two of them, making sure, in case you're not paying attention, we're going to now fabricate, or a better word, contrive a conversation that really didn't need to be there. Then let's double down on that by having the lamest voiceover I have ever witnessed in Star Trek, voiced by, I believe, the Gray character.
Yeah, Ian Alexander.
Where they then, if you didn't catch on still, they then do this corny montage with corny lines, making sure we understand that everybody in the show this year, they're all facing the same things.
And this is where, that is the one that basically was the icing on the cake for me for, in regards of bad, in my opinion, bad writing. Yeah. Because that this type of writing reminded me of, say, something I would have seen in the 90s on CW. Where,
well, not the 90s. The 90s was UPN.
UPN, yeah. Where, well,
let's,
you know,
say, like, let's say mid-2000 CW.
Let's have a Dawson's Creek moment where I'm going to have this monologue about how everybody works well together and kumbaya, and we're all going to be facing this conflict together.
David, do you remember Doogie Howser?
Doogie Howser,
remember,
yeah.
From the 90s and Doogie Howser. That's probably the best example.
That's
there.
The best
where
example.
If people don't know what Doogie Howser is, it's a TV show about a young doctor who was a kid, super intelligent, and he was able to become a doctor. And at the end of every episode, he would write a journal.
Yeah, medical log.
Yeah, and he would talk about all the things he learned. At the end of every episode, today I learned what it meant to be a man. To be a man is simply more than just being a man. A man means you must confront problems. And also, my mother taught me the real meaning of what it means to be a man.
Amen.
You see how repetitive and convoluted that horrible conversation was? That's what Doogie Howser did. And that
is what Discovery
was, how
did.
Banal the voiceover was at the ending.
Yeah. And in conjunction with the whole scene with Culber and Burnham, when you take those two things together, it's very contrived. It's almost like you're looking at your audience and saying, I know you're not that intelligent. I'm going to spell it out for you as the writer.
Yeah.
And it's an insult to the audience. It's an insult to the audience's intelligence. And Star Trek has always been the type of show that is for, like what you alluded to earlier, the intellectual. It's, you're not supposed to talk down to the audience. You're supposed to, you know, pose questions with the audience and say, what do you think? What do you come up with your own interpretation?
And even that conversation between Burnham and Culbert, it was, I rolled my eyes why they were having it, because I knew what they were doing. I knew they were literally spoon-feeding the audience. But yes, I didn't have a problem with the acting. And I understood what they were doing. I didn't agree with it, but I understood why they were doing it. But then they followed up with a three-minute montage where they were kind of saying the exact same thing. I'm like, so you were spoon-feeding us a moment ago, and then now you're still spoon feeding. You're not spoon feeding. At this point, you're like Iago to the Sultan in Aladdin. You're like, you want a cracker? You just shoving it.
No, I don't. I don't want to be happy with everybody. But one of the examples of why this episode is very conflicting for me is because of the up and down, like, performances, and also the production of the script just keeps, it wasn't very consistent. Like, just like you said, you'd have a good performance by two actors for a much unneeded part of a script in Culber and Burnham, but then you'd have a important character narrative point to the story with, say, like Gray and I'm trying to remember Adira, but unfortunately a terrible performance in that important character narrative for Adira. And it because like with those two characters, much like what we were saying about how you need to believe that these characters are with each other. If this is a relationship type of scene, I'm sorry, Adira and Gray, I didn't get the feeling that, oh, they're in a relationship. So when the punchline was, we can't be together. You don't have that punch. You don't have me feeling, oh, that's very sad.
I think the difference though is it's all about acting.
It's acting.
Because
at that point,
Adira Tall, played by Blue, what's her name? Blue Barrio? I want to get their names right. I think it's like
Blue Del Barrio.
Blue Del Barrio?
Yeah.
Great actor. Good job.
She did well in the scene.
I get everything she says and I feel her emotion. I feel the conflict when she was speaking to Gray and the emotions that were starting to well. I buy it. But Ian Alexander,
what happened?
I don't remember them being this poor of an actor during the third season?
No.
Fourth season of Discovery? I mean, my God, what happened? He couldn't even emote properly. I didn't believe a single thing. How many squints of non-acting can you do? One thing that I notice with actors who aren't great or actors who are not comfortable in a specific scene or they're having problems connecting with the material is the first clue to an actor having a problem is the excessive squinting of the eyes.
Yeah, it's the bad acting squint.
It's when they're trying to convey confusion or sadness and they squint, because a lot of people, when they're just learning to act, think that's how you convey a certain feeling, is by trying to change your face.
Yeah.
Most notably, the eyes. It was a very poor performance. And I hate to say that about anything in Star Trek, but it wasn't good.
It wasn't good.
I don't know what happened. Maybe the directing. Maybe the director just couldn't connect at a level with the actor. I don't know.
Well, maybe also, you know, like maybe the fact that there's not much for Gray to do, and that didn't give the actor motivation for the performance. But the thing is kind of like you cannot in a scene with two characters trying to have a relationship type scene, there has to be some emotion. You can't be flat. You can't be flat emotionally.
And it was one-sided. You have Adira obviously showing pangs of distress, knowing that things are about to change in her life or in their life. I don't remember the pronouns. I apologize. I know that the
Ian is Adira, Ian is they.
Even in the show, yes, they are, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I forgot what I was saying. What was I saying before I got distracted with pronouns?
You were saying that Adira in the scene did well. Like she conveyed her turmoil as
they were believable.
They were believable.
They were believable. I struggled with Gray.
Yeah.
A lot.
And I was like going,
even the voiceover that they did at the end, or he did, I believe his pronouns, what he did at the end was unsteady. It didn't feel like he was actually acting. It felt like he was simply reciting a script.
Yeah. And like,
there was no emotion or passion or any type of impact in what was being said.
And I think this is something that's coming to a head for Discovery for me.
I mean, he might as well read a grocery list or a text message from his mother, and then we'd probably get the same effect.
Yeah. And like, this is a problem that I feel Discovery for me has always had, which is they always seem to have this weird, we mentioned it about it earlier in I think it was episode 2 that we covered, that Discovery is the one series that everyone's freaking relationship has to be awkward. Like there's this weird awkwardness with people having relationships, even if it's Burnham and Book. And
Burnham and Book.
Here is a great example that I can point at where it's like, this is something that basically irritates me about Discovery, is like, you're not making me believe that these characters truly care about each other.
The Stamets and Culbert relationship was fixed for the most part.
But it took time,
It took time. But you know how it was fixed? It was fixed when they became individuals and not characters connected at the hip.
Yeah. And
remember we said that we need them to be separate in order to appreciate them and then bring them together. And over the last couple seasons, they have separated the two. And because of that, we have learned to identify and appreciate each character on their own, so that when they do come together in a relationship, you're more open to it. And you're like, okay, I like this. I get it. Because we know about them as individuals separate than simply a contrived relationship that was forced in the first season.
Oh, yeah. And that's the problem. If you're expecting Adira and Gray to get that same, if like the Discovery writers are looking, would look at me and say, give us time, Dave, we're going to fix their relationship.
Yeah.
I'm going to look at them and go, this is your final season. It took you two seasons to fix Culber and Stamets. You're not going to have enough time to fix Gray and Adira by the end of this season.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. All right. So before we wrap today's discussion, we should bring up a little bit of information that was important because they decided to spell it out for us in a gross amount of exposition, which is another problem with this episode. You have a season that seems to be carefully written in order to sustain a certain amount of mystique, you know, mystery, if you will. But then you have a moment where one thing I hate, let me backtrack. You do not, let me say this in a very nice way. The worst way to convey information that an audience needs is by the writer assuming that this moment in the script is the right time to just tell you. You need to show us through the eyes of someone else. And I'll give you an example. There's an episode of, and I know I'm crossing streams here, but it's the only recent example I have that's at the top of my head. Star Wars Bad Batch. They have this mystery. I don't want to spoil it for anyone. There's this very deep-rooted mystery that goes through the entire final season. It has to do with this aspect in the show called Project Necromancer, I believe is what it's called.
Yes.
And we don't know what it is. And when it's time to finally learn what it is, they don't just find some weak, half-assed moment to just tell us. They use a character who finally is allowed entry into this science building. And then you experience all the horrors and atrocities through their eyes. They don't tell you. They allow you to experience visually.
They show you.
They show you, not tell you. And it's a fucking lost art in television.
It is.
And here we have a moment where Colbert's character, as when he was Bix, they decide to tell us 800 years ago, a group of scientists were formed together. First off, it sounds like a premise for an 80s procedural.
Yes.
You know, Coat Seavers and Fall Guy, you know, like, or the A-Team. You know, 800 years ago, a group was formed and united to create a scientific committee that will explore and analyze the progenitor and his creation. Like, what?
You just told us this?
That part is just more of my issues with the script. I like the information. I actually like that reveal when it's all said and done. Yeah. I do like that they're bringing this back to a Federation president who realized the urgency and the importance for all organic life to understand the progenitors.
Yeah.
That was all interesting. It just, the way they delivered that information was so half-assed. It was extremely lazy. And at the end of the day, David, that is my problem with this episode. There were lots of great aspects, but ultimately, this episode suffered from a horrendous script.
Script execution. That's the thing.
Yeah, it's just not that great. The overall, certain things were good, but the script itself wasn't that great.
Yeah.
And David, that's why I got to give this episode my lowest score I've ever given a Discovery episode. It's a 67%.
Wow. Okay.
It's not a good script, David.
I was coming in today and I was like thinking Mike is going to tear me a new one when he sees my score, because I
should have made you go first.
Yeah, exactly. Because like, I was actually thinking my score for this was really harsh because I did not like the way it ended. Overall, I don't like the format of the script. I do not like the format of the story. There were performances in the episode that I'm like, why did this have to happen? I hate holding the cast of actors, because they're all professional actors. I hate holding them over the coals like this.
But it's like,
dude, you've had seasons to tighten this up. You all are professionals.
You're telling me you
and have I felt like Rainer at the end, where I was like, I'm a professional, goddammit. Why aren't you guys professional? That's how I felt like in this episode. And I gave, the score was a 68.
Okay.
Because like, remember, I gave the last score, I think it was an 89. And I didn't 90. Want to, a 90.
You changed it to 90.
Yeah. But like, I gave it a 90. And I was like, good job. You did a really great job. And then you gave me this.
This is what they did with season one. Our biggest problem with season one is that most of it was just a MacGuffin. Most of season one was simply a MacGuffin, so that we can't question what they were actually doing with the mirror universe. The whole Ash Tyler stuff was a giant, right? It was a giant MacGuffin, and it ended up being a giant goose egg. It just amounted to not very much. It was a distraction. They created two mysteries. They had the mystery of Ash Tyler, and they had the mystery of Lorca. And because Lorca was directly connected to the myth arc and the reveal of the mirror universe, they had to keep us distracted. How do you keep us distracted so that we can't figure out that Lorca is actually from the mirror universe? Well, let's make them think that the real mystery is, who's Ash Tyler? They even created a fake actor account on Twitter and tweeted as the actor. They were pulling out all the stops. That's my biggest problem with season one, is because half the season was a fucking MacGuffin.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I don't know what I was going to say. What was my connection? I think I better end, because I'm just getting upset. Yeah, and I don't want to get upset because I like this show and I like the actors on this show. I think I'm just disappointed that the script wasn't good. Overall, guess what? It happens. Every season of Star Trek has that episode. You're like, what?
Yeah.
I don't really like that. But the difference is, in a season of, say, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Next Generation, you have 20 plus episodes. So one bad episode, you're like, moving on.
Moving on.
With a show that has been shortened down to 10 episodes, and it's its final season, and your third episode in, you're struggling like a motherfucker. Well, it doesn't bode well.
Yeah, and that's why I'm hard on particularly that Gray and Adira storyline, because I'm like going, essentially, you just wrote them off.
Well, I hope it is. I hope if they don't move on past this, then I'm going to scratch my head more and say, well, you fucking made us watch 5 minutes of poor acting to end this relationship.
That you gave us a season's worth of.
That now you're going to bring back for some reason. Let it die. It's over. Let's move on. Anyways. All right, David, that brings us to the end. But I'm also very positive.
Very positive.
It might have sounded a little aggressive, but I'm just being honest. I think I do a lot of good commentary on Star Trek Discovery, but I have to be honest, and this episode wasn't that great.
No.
All right. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.